I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Beer and boutique liquor have taken center stage on Vermont's alcohol scene, with award-winning local brews and spirits making Vermont known around the country and the world. But what about wine? Vermont has a tough climate for wine, but there are plenty of vineyards trying innovative approaches to viticulture, and lots of Vermonters who know about wine from all over the world. So if you're a wine aficionado or just a dabbler, or maybe even someone who feels intimidated choosing a bottle, stay tuned. We're joined today by two Kevins with lots of great advice and insight. Kevin Clayton is the owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne. Kevin Ring is a sommelier and wine and beverage director at Twin Farms, an upscale resort in Barnard. This pairing goes with anything, but they are specifically here to answer your questions about wines from near and far. Kevin and Kevin, welcome back. Nice to have you with us. We are in, I think, day six now of a heat wave. So what wine pairs great with a heat wave? Kevin Clayton, what do you think?
I've been enjoying a wine from northern Spain. It's on the Bay of Biscay. It's called Chacolina. And it's low in alcohol, like 10.5%. And it's really bright and refreshing. And you just put a big chill on it. And it just sort of gives you that little lift to get over the heat.
So light, low alcohol. I typically turn to Vino Verde when I want something sort of effervescent and low alcohol. How does that
This
match
is a
up.
Notch above that. So it's a little more sophisticated. And just Vino Verdes, I think, are 7.5%, 8%. This is 10.5%. It's not that much higher in alcohol, but it's a little more sophisticated.
Are you saying I'm unsophisticated, Kevin?
No. I was saying I preferred the Chacolina.
Kevin Ring, what about for you?
I'm going to go with the no-brainer, which is rosé. And rosé sparkling, even better. If you're going to go with a white wine, I'd prefer something a little more acidity, a little more aromatic. Again, lower in alcohol, like Kevin says. Yeah, I agree with Kevin. I think a little more sophisticated, but I'm not going to pick a fight with you.
Yeah, it's my show. Don't pick a fight with me. Speaking of rosés, we got a question from Danek who says, does anyone know a good rosé from Vermont? Are there any Vermont vineyards making rosés and good ones? Uh-oh, the Kevins
are... there's a few. I think, I think rosé is a... It's the only growth market in the entire wine industry, and they're also light. Someone referred to them like in terms of a pastry chef, you get one chance to make it, which is kind of like rosé, and then you take a red wine and you have more time to work on it. So the folks down at La Garagista make a few interesting rosés, and I think the folks, the ones I've tried up at Shelburne Vineyards, they make a few. So I think there's lots of options, and those are the ones I've tried lately.
Why is rosé the growth area for wine right now?
They're light, they're refreshing, they're low in alcohol, and it seems to be, super trendy, so why not?
Kevin Ring?
Yeah, and people aren't scared of them anymore. People assumed that pink wine for a long time was white Zinfandel. It was sweet, it was sticky, it was what your aunt drank, and you didn't want to have anything to do with it. But traditional rosé is going to be bright, cherries, strawberries, and it's refreshing and higher acidity. It just works perfect. And with little bubbles, you get a little sparkling rosé. And you're talking about Lagerista. I think what they're doing as far as the Vermont wines, I think that's their sweet spot, is their Petiant Naturels or Pet Nats. And she does one with rosé.
They're also beautiful to look at. You just see it in a glass, and that lovely pink color is really pretty.
Yeah.
So, you said, Kevin Ring, not your aunt's sticky, sweet wine, but actually we have a listener who's looking for exactly that, a very sweet, sticky wine. Anne says, I grew up on my grandmother's wine, which was quite sweet. Can you recommend a sweet, sweet wine?
So are we thinking dessert wine or just a,
I don't know. Maybe take us in the direction that you think would be appropriate for a sweet wine that's really going to give us something good.
Well, something on the red side. If you're looking for something that's got a lot of fruit and jamminess, grape called Petite Syrah, especially when it's done in California, tends to have that sweeter side to it and a little more of that stewed fruit and jamminess. So maybe that's what she's hunting for. White-wise, Riesling is one of those grapes, depending on where it comes from, how it's grown, can be bone dry. can have residual sugar and be sweet and lower alcohol. So I would suggest on the white side maybe a Mittelmosel Riesling. If they want to try something red and big and jammy, maybe a Petite Sirah.
And Kevin Clayton, you can find lovely, very sweet ice wines and such from right around here and up in Quebec.
Yeah, those are wonderful, and they tend to be higher in alcohol and really unctuous, so you just need a little tiny bit of it. But when you asked the question, I was thinking of Moscato or Brachetto. These are two Italian wines sort of from Piedmont that by law can only be 5 or 7% alcohol. They're a little spritzy, so I call it my mom wine. Like I can have lunch with my mom with it, and she likes it because she used to like drink Blue Nun. But it's a little spritzy, it's a little fruity, it's a little sweet. I kind of call it like the sorbet of wine. And anybody can enjoy it because they're just delicious.
You've both now mentioned low alcohol content or the alcohol content of the wine a couple of times now. And certainly, you know, in summertime, if you're looking for something refreshing, if you're hoping to have a couple of glasses, it makes sense to know the alcohol content. But is lower alcohol content something that is trending in wine right now? Or is this just something that you think about when you're talking about what types of wines?
It's Kevin Ring here. I think in what I do, especially with food pairing, that lower alcohol works better with food. I mean, I hunt them down. I don't want something too big and too high in alcohol. I don't want it to steal the show. You know, our culinary team does a lot of work. And, you know, I'm there just to highlight it or to accent it or to, you know, sort of be the salt in the meal with the wine. And if you have something that is too high in alcohol, it just takes over.
Hmm.
It's Kevin Clayton here. I think alcohol levels, like you were talking about with food, certainly lower alcohol levels. But let's talk about where those levels are. You know, the lighter wines are 5 to 7%. Those dessert wines are the Chocolina 10.5. You're looking up to 16 or 17 for a Zinfandel or Cabernet or some big red California wines. And I personally feel that it's just too big for the heat.
Hmm.
And the other thing I think it's really important for people to understand is like don't try to quench your thirst with wine. Quench your thirst first with water and then enjoy some wine because the bigger alcohol wines, that's what gets you into trouble and makes you feel like you have a headache or you don't feel good afterwards. But I see a trend in people coming in the door asking for lower alcohol wines because they just feel like they can assimilate them better and they have a better time with their meal and a better time in the evening sleeping and it just seems to work better.
Let's go to Judy who's on the line with us from Alberg. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
Great.
Well, we traveled last spring in Portugal, and we sampled their green wines. And actually, I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm a summer Vermonter. And we were able to get three or four different kinds in Pennsylvania. I have not yet been able to get green wine here in Vermont. Is it possible to do that?
Judy, are you looking for Vermont-produced green wines or just any?
Not necessarily. Just some green wine because it's lighter and it's sometimes a little effervescent and it really is delicious as a summertime wine.
Judy, thanks for the call. And I feel totally vindicated here as a Vino Verde drinker. So Vino Verde is green wine. So what might Judy want to try now that she's back from Portugal to give her that same sense of lovely, effervescent, light wine?
This is Kevin Clayton here. I carry 10 of those in stock all the time. We sell a ton of it because it's relatively inexpensive. They're all under $10 a bottle, and they're just so much fun to drink. And for any number of reasons, and they're just super easy to enjoy.
And Kevin Ring, when Judy's looking for something, where might she find? You know, if you're looking for it as green wine, you should probably be looking for something that says Vino Verde, right? V-I-N-H-O, if it's spelled in the Portuguese way. But where, like, if you're looking down the aisle in a store and you see Cabernet, a sign for Cabernet, you see a sign for Zinfandel, you see a sign for Chardonnay, where should you be looking in the wine aisles?
Well, my suggestion on a retail side, and this is more Kevin's world, but is find a wine shop to work with. Get to know them. You know, go see Kevin. If you're not in Kevin's neighborhood, go see the guys at Daedalus. If you're down in the Waterbury or Stowe area, go to Cork. Go make a relationship with a wine shop. Don't buy your wine at Costco. I think I did this last time. You know, buy your wine somewhere where you have a person you can talk to. So you don't have to hunt for it. You just say, excuse me, I'm looking for this. Where's the Vino Verde? Where's some green wine? Where's something similar that I could try? Experiment. Push yourself out of your box. Try something different.
But Kevin Clayton, if somebody comes to you and says, I'm looking for a good wine, I think maybe white, and then they get a question from you like, well, what kinds of flavors are you looking for? And do you want bold? Is it, you know, it can start to feel like, I don't know, just a wine? You know, should people get over that feeling of intimidation?
You brought up a really good point because even in my shop, I have 1,200 different wines and we have access to over 10,000 and probably more than that in warehouses around America. The first question I ask people is, what's your budget?
Mm-hmm.
What do you like to drink? How many people are coming to the table? And I think the intimidation around wine is something I just work so hard to try to break down because really it's something we gather around the table. And with just a few simple questions, we can find something that you like. And I would just say, explore. But and don't hesitate to ask questions because every question's a good question. I think we're all – like you called us wine experts. I'm like I'm only lucky that I get to try a bunch of stuff and I never consider myself an expert only because I'm always learning stuff all the time and people are bringing me new things. And it's, we're all that way. So just ask questions and hopefully you can find a place people make you feel comfortable asking questions.
When you say you have 1,200 wines in stock, you know, maybe access to 10,000 or more, that's one of the struggles that I feel about wine. There's just so much choice. First of all, you know, then you can get into your routines the same way you do with any food or beverage that you like of, you know, this is sort of my standby. But it's just there's so many options that I find that a little overwhelming.
Yeah, you're correct. It's overwhelming for us too. So that's where, like for us, we're working on I'm calling it curating, like a museum in a way. But I'm working to find the best wines at every price point. So when you walk in the door and go like, I got 10 bucks, and I'm like, all right, I got like 5 different things to choose from. I can make it easy for you.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we can lay out our space so that it's easy for you. And I think America is just known for overwhelming amount of choices of everything. It's daunting, especially in a place like ours. You walk in the door and there's 1,200 different things all in the same package.
Right.
So that's where what we were talking about earlier, find a place where you can feel comfortable with the people running it and then you just can walk in the door and ask questions. And if you go out the door and you come back and you say, boy, I really like that and maybe I want to try something different. It's like, great, we did our job. And hopefully it'll be what will work for you.
If you have a question about wine for Kevin Clayton or Kevin Ring, our number is 800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. You can post notes on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or on VPR's Facebook page. Miriam is calling in from Williston. Hey, Miriam, you're on the line.
Oh, hi there. I'm limited only to drinking Sauvignon Blancs because of the allergies that I have to the tannins. And I'm wondering if there's some other substitute that I could drink that is comparable to Sauvignon Blanc and safe for me to drink, even if there's something like that in Vermont being made. So that's my question.
Miriam, thanks for the question. Kevin Ring?
Yeah, so Sauvignon Blancs and white wines are going to have less tannins because they don't spend as much time on skins. So you could try rosé because it's a small amount of time on skins.
And if when you say on skins, you mean the skin of the grape, right?
I'm being wine geeky here. Rosé is made it starts off in the same process of making red wine where the fermentation starts with the whole grape. White wine, it's pressed off immediately. The fresh juice is fermented. Rosé, you start a little bit of time on fermentation. They use the term on skin, so it picks up some of the pigments, some of the tannins, some of the structure. Then the winemaker will press out before fermentation is done and then continue on. So you have a little bit of tannins, not as much in red. Sauvignon Blanc, I don't see why Sauvignon Blanc would have any less tannins than any other unoaked wine. You do get a little bit of more tannins when you put wine in a barrel and oak it. And you were talking earlier where we were asked about value wines and trends. When I was in South Africa last year, I found a great Sauvignon Blanc Chardonnay blend coming from the Western Cape. So good value, fun wines. So, stick with the Sauvignon Blanc or try rosé. Try Chenin Blanc. Try something that doesn't have any oak.
Miriam, is that helpful to you? You got some ideas now?
I appreciate that because I've been limited. I can drink when I go out, and then they may not have the Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, which I find has a better, fresher taste, and the tannins seem to be a lot less than, let's say, a Sauvignon Blanc from France, which seems a little bit more, oaky in that sense of the word. So, yeah, and was there anything in Vermont that I that is being produced that I can drink along those lines? I just wonder if there's a rosé that is made here in Vermont.
Yeah, Miriam, thanks for that. And we as we were talking about earlier, there are some rosés now being produced here in Vermont. Anything low tannins that you would recommend, Miriam, take a look at? Kevin Clayton?
I think it's just going to be trying. I think one of the things is to ask the producer if the wine was fermented in stainless steel. I think that may be a more important factor than what the perceived allergy to tannins are. I think also trying to find someone that's doing really clean winemaking with organic fruit, good vineyard management, I think you're going to get a purer wine.
You do or don't want it to have been aged in steel?
You want it to be aged in steel so that you take the wood component out. So maybe if there's allergies to wood or like what Kevin was talking about earlier, the skin contact is not as minimal in a lot of fresh white wines. There's the Le Crescent at Shelburne Vineyards. That might be a place to start. And it's going to be an experimenting thing and then getting a notebook and keeping track. But I think finding good producers that are, organic fruit, stainless steel fermentation, I think she'll have a better chance of not having a reaction.
I love the idea of a notebook, too, because there have been times in my life where I've had a wine that I really like, and then I can sort of vaguely remember the label. It was like a, cream-colored label. It had some words on it. But for the life of me, I can't remember what the wine was, so that idea of a note. And yes, Kevin Ring is saying, take a picture. This was pre-cell phones, but now, yeah, you certainly can do that, right?
I see a ton of it in what I do. Everybody gets their phone out, takes a picture of it so they can look for it later on. And yeah, it's very helpful. We don't rely on our devices quite a bit, and this is a good thing you can rely on them for.
We got a note from Chuck who wants to know if you could suggest a low-cost wine to pair with burgers. I'm going to get this from both of you. Kevin Ring, what do you think? Burgers and wine.
Burgers and wine. I think a good place to go, and I think I did this last time, but I really love some of the Austrian reds because I think they're great with barbecue, good value. But I'm going to go back to South Africa again, a grape called Sinso. It's a Rhone blending grape, grows really well in South Africa. It's a lighter red. I use a lot of lighter reds earlier in the meal. And what I do, another one from Piedmont would be Dolcetto. Is a good pizza and a burger wine. So Sinso, Dolcetto.
Kevin Clayton?
I like some Rhone blends. Like I had a friend of mine makes a wine called Mazcaz, and I put a red in the refrigerator. And I forgot about it. I brought it out the next day. Cold, it was delicious. So I was like, this works. I think it's just there's so much good wine being made now. Technology is so good to make good wine that isn't expensive. And again, it's finding things you like. I like Barberas. People love Zinfandel. It's interesting. People love a different say for a burger, someone will like Pinot Noir, someone will like Zinfandel, someone will like Cabernet, someone will like Blaufränkisch, someone will like Cote de Rhone, someone will like Barberas, someone will like Nebbiolos. There's so many possibilities.
This is where I'm like, fine, just pick a wine. If somebody's going to think it's good with a burger, if you like the wine and you like the burger, you're fine. But there is an art. I mean, clearly, you've got a job in it, Kevin Ring. There is an art to pairing your food and your wine so that you're enhancing both. And I just find that sometimes it's like, I don't even know where to start, especially if there are so many different choices. Then, my go-to of like red wine and meat isn't necessarily going to enhance the meal, but I don't know what is.
No, and I'm a guy who likes to do things that I shouldn't do. So I tend to use the opposite mentality that, white with fish and red with meat. And there's quite a bit of times I'll use a lighter red and, like Kevin said, sometimes with a chill on it to serve with fish dishes, especially something like salmon, something that has a little bit more oiliness. You're not always looking at the protein. You're looking at how it's prepared, what the sauce is. If you look in Bordeaux, they serve a lot of red wine with like trout and river fishes. And you would be like, really? But, that's the food of the region. And you will see them serve Cabernet Franc and Cabernet Sauvignon blends with fish dishes.
Now you're just making me hungry. This is the problem with doing a show at mealtime. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking wine with sommelier Kevin Ring, wine and beverage director at Twin Farms in Barnard, and with Kevin Clayton, owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne. And before we get back to Kevin Ring and Kevin Clayton, let's talk for a few minutes with another Kevin, Kevin Cleary. This Kevin is the owner of the Vermont Wine School based in Burlington. Kevin Cleary, nice to have you on the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
So you're teaching people about wine at the wine school. Is this just for people who are in the industry, who are, you know, working in restaurants or bars, or is it really for anybody who wants to know more about wine?
No, it's pretty much for anybody who wants to know about wine. We actually have a lot of consumers that take the classes, as well as a lot of people that are in the industry also.
What do you learn in wine school?
You learn a lot. You learn, I mean, I think Kevin Clayton said something about, you know, being a wine expert, there's just so much to learn, and there really is. It's a never-ending pursuit. So we learn about the major grape varieties. We'll talk about the major regions, how you make wine, how you grow grapes, and we actually do, you know, have some discussions about food and wine pairing and matching as well.
What's been exciting to you since you opened this school? Because it's still relatively new to you. So what do you love about having the school aspect?
Yeah, well, the school's actually been around since 2011, so it's been a little bit of a while, it's been around for a little while, but I just love the fact that people, when they come to the class not knowing much or anything about wine, and when they leave after 6 to 8 weeks of these classes, they just have a really great appreciation for it, and they're really excited. So that's what gets me going.
Can people get certified to be a sommelier through your classes?
Yeah, so all the classes I teach, they do have certifications, so they all have exams. I do not teach the sommelier. That's the Guild of Sommelier classes, so I don't teach those. That being said, you know, anyone really that's working in the industry, that's on the floor, that's taken some courses and is, you know, talking about wine and selling wine and managing a wine list, you know, is basically considered a sommelier. So you don't necessarily need the certification for that.
So beyond the basic level of education and understanding of wine, what are the benefits of getting more education, getting deeper into these classes and stepping up your knowledge? I mean, what, give me a concrete sense of what I would know more after doing, you know, 3 or 4 levels of training versus after reading one book.
Yeah, so what you've been talking about today, I've been listening to the show before I got the phone call, and it's just, you know, there's so much choice out there. So just having a base of knowledge, and yes, there are courses, there are books out there that you can read, and there's some online courses that you can do. But I think getting, you know, taking one of the classes that I teach and being around other people, tasting the wines and seeing it in context of where they're coming from, how they're made, will give you a much better understanding of what styles that you like, what styles that maybe you want to try, and what styles that will go with the things that you eat.
So before we let you go, Kevin, do you have a suggestion for a good wine for a heat wave?
Oh, for a heat wave? Yeah, anything sparkling and anything white and sparkling. So I'm a real fan lately. I just got back from Italy, and it was a trip, an educator's trip, and we only did sparkling wine, not Prosecco. We didn't taste any Prosecco. There's a lot more to Italian sparkling than Prosecco, but French Accorta and Trento DOC wines, traditionally made sparkling wines for a heat wave or my go-to right now.
Sounds great. Kevin Cleary is the owner of the Vermont Wine School based in Burlington. Kevin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
And we are still talking wine with Kevin Clayton and Kevin Ring. And we got a note from Jeff who says, what can you tell us about the choices in non-alcoholic wines? Kevin Ring, is there good non-alcoholic wine?
There's actually, I wouldn't say there's good non-alcoholic wines, but there's a couple wineries that are doing wine juices. What they do is they cold stabilize the fruit or the juice after it's been pressed, so fermentation does not happen. And I stock them and use them because I get a fair amount of guests who come in and who they can't partake in the experience because they don't drink, they're pregnant, they're on meds, and the wine juices they are obviously sweet because they haven't gone through fermentation, but they're varietally correct on the nose. The ones that I work with come from a Sonoma winery called Navarro, and they're Gewurztraminer and Pinot Noir. The funny thing is they charge you the same amount for their unfermented wine juice as they do for the bottle of wine. Yeah. But they've been a big hit. You know, the Gewurztraminer, it smells like lychees, like Gewurztraminer does. I actually a lot of times will serve it with a little side of club soda, so you can sort of make a spritzer out of it. But guests really, really appreciate that. So the de-alcoholized wines, to me, it's, and I'm sorry, it's kind of like drinking non-alcoholic beer. Just don't.
Kevin Clayton, what do you think?
I agree with you, Kevin Ring. I'm not a fan of the alcohol wines at all. What we carry is a French sparkling cider with no added sugar, and it's dry and it's delicious. And I think people are looking for something in the glass that maybe imitates wine or gives them the sensory experience they're looking for with flavors.
Yeah, but, what you talked about earlier, Kevin, with that sophistication being a key word. When you know there's a lot going on with simple syrups now that are herbal, you know, that have a little bit more depth of flavor, and so it's not just, you just don't feel like you're drinking a soda or a fruit juice if you're going in that direction. And I imagine it's the same for people who want that sort of wine experience but no alcohol.
I think what you just talked about is the direction to take the people in who are looking for non-alcoholic wines. With sparkly wines or, blueberry juice or all these kind of different herbal infusions that people are making, you can make as sophisticated a drink as you like and really being enjoying yourself at the table along with everybody else with a glass of wine. And I think they're probably better for you too than the de-alcoholized wines.
Why?
I think less junk. There's a lot of stuff you don't want to know about in commercially made wine.
So let's talk about that, because one of the things that we want to talk about is this movement towards or growth in the all-natural wine area. So when you say there's a lot of junk, what are you talking about, and so what are the alternatives?
There's a lot of commercially made wine that's made in the millions of gallons. So they add like stuff called Mega Purple or different stabilizers and different things like that. And so they're actually finding levels of glyphosate, which is Roundup and, you know, arsenic and different things in sort of those commercially grown wines. And we try to focus on smaller family-run wineries where there's really great farming practices and traceability. So you can actually call these people up or text them and go like, hey, what's going on with your stuff? And they give you an honest answer. Because right now, there's no law requiring anybody to put what else or ingredients on a bottle of wine. And I think if some of the large companies did that, they may not be selling wine.
Hmm. Kevin Ring?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to talk about this. There, I looked it up again. There are 62 chemicals that can be added to a bottle of wine that the Alcohol and Tobacco or USDA do not allow – don't make you put on the label. The bottling laws or labeling laws for shampoo are more strict than they are for a consumable product like wine. There is this new sort of trend called natural wines. I'm not a fan of the term because it doesn't mean much. But to me, low intervention wines, you know, you have to understand that wine first and foremost starts out as an agricultural product. So if you're growing it like you're growing a million acres of soybeans, you're using tons of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers. So if you can grow biodynamically or organically, you're going to have a better base product to start with. So you're not going to need to use all of these additives. If you're using a natural yeast or spontaneous fermentation, you're not going to need to use lab yeast. You're not going to need to use a lot of the additives that are around. You know, a lot of the additives are around supporting the cultivated yeast. So knowing, working with a smaller producer, and they don't need to be labeled organically grown grapes. They could say organically grown grapes and then they can do whatever they want in the winemaking process. And it doesn't have to have a biodynamic certification. A lot of the European producers don't want to bother with the extra cost of getting those certifications, or they don't like being told what to do. So knowing, you know, Kevin and I, we know our importers, we know our producers. I visit them. Every spring I go somewhere. These people have become friends, family members, and getting to know what they do and how they do it. I've talked to a lot of bigger producers who switched over to growing organic when they started having grandkids and kids, and they realized, you know, their vineyard manager guy says, oh, I'm spraying today, you know, keep the kids inside. And they're like, oh my God, what am I doing?
So they've actually changed their practices.
They've changed their practices, yeah.
Let's go to Andrea calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, good morning. Love your show. I had a question. I wrote already so many good tips. I hope you have it also all on your website so I can look up the right spelling for all these foreign names for the wines.
Not yet, but we'll work on putting it up after the show, Andrea.
That would be great. My particular question was, I grew up in Germany and lived there half of my life, and I used to drink a wine with a special preference called Bocksbeutel. You spell it B-O-C-K-S E-U-T-E-L, one word. And that's a wine, white wine, which comes from the area close to France. There is a mountain range, a relatively small one, which is all rocks. The wine grows on the thin crust on top of the rocks and within the cracks of the rocks. So the grapes. So the wine has a very crispy, hearty, dry kind of character, and just a unique, wonderful flavor because the grapes grow very slow because they don't have so much lush, fertile earth to work on. Anyways, I would love to find that wine here or something similar. So that's why I wanted to ask your wine specialist.
Andrea, thanks for the call. Any suggestions or ideas for Andrea?
So I think this is the stump the chump phase
of
the show
really.
Here. I don't think Kevin or I know this grape. I know I don't. I'm intrigued by it because I love those more aromatic, higher acid whites. So I'm certainly going to be looking for it. And I'm sure Jane can share my email on later on. And if I find it or can get it or find an importer or a distributor, yeah, because I would love to have it too.
And Kevin Clayton, anything that it sounds similar to?
Not necessarily, but I think the soil type that she's referring to, like there's certain places in Austria, in these higher altitude regions in France, like the Savoie or the Jura or the Arbois, that it takes longer for these grapes to mature. And they're on these kind of soils. And because they take longer to mature and they're up at elevation, you get this complexity you just don't get anywhere else. And I think there may be something we could find that's in around here that we can get that might help her.
We got a note from Jessica who says, I don't consider myself a wine connoisseur, but I know what I like. My latest wine obsession is with skin contact wines, also called orange wines. They are funky, almost bitter whites. Not sure if they come in reds as well. When, where, how have they originated? I had never heard of them until this year. Thank you, Daedalus. And was recently in a self-described high-end wine store in Denver, and the salesperson had never heard of these wines. So, orange wines.
They've been around as long as wine has. I think they came from the Georgian region first. And it's the – like I was talking earlier when we were talking about rosé, you normally press out a white wine. They spend time on the skin, so they pick up white – with being a white wine, they're not picking up the pigments and the color and making a rosé or the red, but you're picking up the tannins, some more of the structures. A lot of them can be very viscousy and oily, and they get that little – the orange comes from the sort of the color for the pigmentation from the skins. So they've been around forever. I think they work really – to me, there's a lot of nuttiness and earthiness, a term that I love to use, a funk to them. And they go really well with cheeses. It's another one of those sort of trends that if they're done well, they're great. And if they're not, the other end of the spectrum.
Speaking of trends, how about cans, canned wine? Pro, con?
I've had some nice canned wines. A friend of mine in California, Faith Armstrong, makes a rosé and a white wine in the cans. I think the genre is made around being able to take them to the beach and the park and all these places where you're not to have glass. So it gives you that opportunity to bring wine with you. There's a danger because there's two glasses of wine in a can. So that's a lot of alcohol. But my own preference is if I had a bottle or can of the same wine, I would like it out of the bottle. That's my personal preference.
So before we close this segment, for people who are thinking, I want a really nice wine for graduation or an anniversary, can you get a really special wine for, $25? Or do you have to spend $100, $200 to get that really amazing wine? How do you think about pricing?
You can get a great bottle of wine for $25. You really can. And this is where I'm going to bounce it to Kevin because this is what he does. But yeah, don't think that you need to spend a lot of money on wine.
Winemaking is so good right now that you're in the 95th percentile in that price range. And our
at the $25 price range?
Between $15 and $30, that's our sweet spot. And you're up – there's stuff more expensive, but the people who are making wine at that level, there's so many good wines at that price range that are just wonderful.
So the trick is finding somebody who can guide you to the ones that are really good. Well, I appreciate both of you helping to guide us and have this conversation with us. Kevin Clayton is the owner of Village Wine and Coffee in Shelburne. Kevin Ring is a sommelier and wine and beverage director at Twin Farms in Barnard. Thanks very much to both of you. Appreciate it.